Right now, we're very happy to have on the air with us Norman Salomon. He's a longtime activist, syndicated columnist, and author. His recent books include Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, and War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, which was made into a very compelling documentary film. Norman is the founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of Roots Action, and he ran a close third in a June 2012 primary race for California's 2nd District North Coast Congressional seat, which we'll be talking about tonight. But, Norman, appreciate you making time to be with us this evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you.
Your recent article, I think, struck a chord with me, and I'm sure many others who read it across the country. The article titled "The Progressive Caucus Enabling Obama's Rightward Moves." You really accused the 75-member Progressive Caucus of really not challenging President Obama's compromises with right-wing Republicans in this past Congress, particularly in the fiscal cliff tax deal that permanently took $3.9 trillion off the table in what was negotiated to be permanent tax cuts forevermore until, I guess, new policy comes down the line. But, Norman, again, I think I was feeling the same thing when I was reading the vote count on the approval, where members of the Progressive Caucus, like most other Democrats in the House, voted for this compromise. But tell us what your thinking was on the weakness of the Progressive Caucus these days.
Well, this has become a very chronic pattern over the last 4 years, and I think less and less defensible. There is no longer the threat of Barack Obama being a one-term president. And so during the earlier abdications, you might say, or cave-ins, however you want to put it, at least there was that rationale that push comes to shove. It's important to back up Obama because the threat of a Republican president being elected in 2012 was real. It's no longer real. And so what we saw on New Year's Day of this year is a replication of a pattern that goes way back to 2009 when the health care reform debate was raging in Washington. And at one point in that year, in the early fall, the chairs of the 70-plus member Progressive Caucus, on behalf of the entire caucus, which is the largest one on Capitol Hill, composed of Democrats, sent a letter to President Obama saying that unless there was a, quote, robust, unquote, public option included in the health care bill, that those members of the Progressive Caucus would vote no. And in fact, by the early part of 2010, when health care legislation was passed by Congress, not only was there no robust public option in the bill, there was no public option at all, and yet every single member of that Progressive Caucus voted for it. So one of the big problems is if you promise something publicly or threaten something publicly, depending on how you look at it, then you got to go ahead and do it. And if you don't intend to follow through on your promise or threat, you shouldn't make that promise or threat to begin with. And we've seen this replicated most recently just a few weeks ago, where 2 weeks ago, here as we speak in the middle of January 2013, on New Year's Day, members of the Progressive Caucus, with only six exceptions, voted to proceed with approving this deficit deal, this fiscal deal, that really backtracked on some major promises coming from the White House, including refusing to approve continuation of tax cuts for those over $250,000 a year.
So, Norman, there are many, many Democrats in Congress who voted for that tax compromise there at the 11th hour on January 1st, who will make the claim that although it wasn't the best deal, it was the best deal they could get from the Republicans in the House, where many Republicans, where many of the Tea Party Republicans voted against it. Do you buy the argument that pragmatic politics sometimes has to be a priority rather than ideology or standing on principle?
Well, sometimes you do have to give some ground, but when you keep giving ground again and again and again, even when you're holding the whip hand, as the saying goes, and are in a position to get much better, then it becomes problematic when it's a pattern. There was an incisive article in the Onion newspaper a couple of years ago saying, quoting President Obama, saying that, well, you know, politics is about compromise, and you know, it's about Democrats giving what they want and Democrats giving what they want until a deal can be reached. And as unfortunately is the case here, so often the Onion cuts through the blather much better than the mainstream media. So it's been this continuous pattern of the Democratic Party leadership moving towards the Republican Party without standing ground and then waking up a week or a month or 6 months later and being told, well, you've got to compromise again, with very little give from the other direction. And so I think that is chronic here. When you look at the votes and you see that well over 60 of the votes here for this measure, New Year's Day, came from the Progressive Caucus, when the margin of passage was 44. And so you have this ongoing problem where, is the Progressive Caucus going to simply do what the president tells them, or are they going to be a counterweight to the right-wing Republicans who have so much control, or at least power, in the House?
Norman, there is a lot of the pundits that you hear on television, read in the newspaper, talk about the ideal political situation, where, as you talked about before, the idea that bipartisanship should rule the day. There's a group called No Labels that talks about, hey, we got to meet somewhere in the middle, and that the mushy middle somehow is the right place for this country to be. And the folks who make that argument basically say, hey, the country's polarized and neither side is going to get what they want. Is that the philosophy you think President Obama is coming from?
Well, he's talked a lot about middle ground, but he also has repeatedly said that he would not give ground beyond insisting that the tax cuts end for those over a quarter of $1 million. And yet, even though he had said that fairly recently, it ends up, he said, oh, I'm fine with 400,000 for individuals, 450,000 for a couple. And this, he's thrown down gauntlets so often to pick them up again, that simply as a negotiating strategy, it's a disaster, because at this point, Republicans have, with good reason, reason to believe that he can be rolled no matter what he says, and he sort of sits down and makes concessions before the push-pull of negotiation is in place, or at least underway. And in a similar way, the Progressive Caucus making declarations, it appears the vast majority of it, including its leadership, can be rolled by the president. So you have this sort of recurring domino effect, which has been very injurious. And now that the president will not face another election, I think from a pragmatic standpoint, progressives need to demand of members of the Progressive Caucus in particular that they no longer defer to the president of the United States, that being a progressive should come first, and being a member of the Democratic Party should be second.
Again, we have this discourse in our country where a lot of those who are commentators on politics in Washington talk about extremes on both sides and certainly cast aspersions at anybody who takes a principled stand on any issue. And basically, they'll accuse the right and left and the Democrats and Republican Party as being mirror images of each other. And I'm wondering, you know, how you respond to the idea that, you know, the folks who stand on principle are somehow blocking progress.
Yeah, part of the problem is this sort of implicit assumption that there's something moderate about so-called moderates. When you have this threat to Social Security, when you have this tremendous military spending, when you have inaction on climate change, when you have the abrogation now under two administrations of basic civil liberties like habeas corpus, what is moderate about shredding the Bill of Rights, increasing the gaps between rich and poor, threatening those elderly and others who depend on Social Security with cuts, even when they depend on Social Security to keep them out of poverty, that and so much more indicates that so-called moderate or centrist politics are not moderate in the sense that we would maintain or advance our humane values. And I think it's so important for us to reshuffle the deck and not simply internalize the language that the mass media throw at us.
Very well said, because that's exactly where, you know, I'm thinking about the false equivalency that the media uses to measure arguments on you know, from different political spectrums is really dishonest. As you said, you know, we could have, famously, as Alexander the late great Alexander Coburn once said, you know, the media trying to split it down the middle can have a you know, an argument with itself on the pros and cons of cannibalism. You know, when we're talking about making deep cuts to social safety net programs like Social Security and Medicare, is there really another side here? You know, it's amazing. So I think what you said there is quite true.
Well, you know, we've lived through, if we've been around for decades, we've lived through many other eras too, where the news media and many politicians framed the appropriate compromise as being a moderate way of splitting difference between what are called extremes. So when people were advocating for civil rights laws in the early 1960s, we're told, no, that's too extreme. When people said the U.S. should stop bombing Vietnam and withdraw troops, we're told, no, that's extreme. That's a middle, not a middle position. And today, with such the voracious power of Wall Street, the continuing military spending, this really morally indefensible inaction on climate change, and I could go on all night and I won't, to accept this definition of what it is to be so-called moderate as though that's something good, I think is, you know, more than problematic, it's extremely dangerous. We're now at a point where we have to be willing to say not just that politics is the art of the possible, but perhaps more salient, it has to be the art of the imperative to define that and go ahead in politics in that way.
We're speaking with Norman Solomon here on Counterpoint tonight, activist, syndicated columnist, and author. Ran for Congress this past June. We'll hear more about that in a few moments and the lessons learned there. But Norman, have you spoken with Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison, the co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus in the House?
I have spoken with them, but not this year, not since the vote. And I should say by disclaimer that when I ran for Congress out here in California, one of the co-chairs, Grijalva, endorsed me. The other, Ellison, endorsed an opponent. I have high regard for both of them. I have high regard for most of the members of the Progressive Caucus. There are now 72 in the caucus. As of the old Congress, which ended on January 3rd of this year, there were 75. And just to sort of sketch that out again, I think I used the word number six. It's actually seven. Seven of those 75 caucus members voted against this fiscal deal, and only 16 out of the entire Democratic members of the House. You know, this is, in a way, your question touches on that while we should, I think, or certainly they deserve to have us give a lot of respect for Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison as co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus, we cannot defer to them because we hold them in high regard. The great Howard Zinn so often pointed out the crucial difference between social movements and elected officials. And in social movements, progressives have not only the opportunity but the necessity and capacity to say and do things that even some of the best members of Congress just don't feel comfortable doing. And that certainly includes challenging somebody in the White House who is pursuing policies that will whittle away at the social compact and continue a set of priorities that militarize without sustaining the social fabric in our own communities.
Norman, in your view, what's at stake in the coming debt ceiling negotiations where previously in talks, President Obama has actually offered increases in the eligibility age for Medicare and has more recently proposed was something called Change CPI, which in effect is a benefit cut for Social Security recipients over time. What should activists be doing here? What can activists do, and what's the urgency?
Well, I think it's crucial for activists and really anybody concerned about Social Security, Medicare, and spending priorities to insist that there must be not only no rise in the eligibility age for Medicare, but also that there be no cuts whatsoever in Social Security. The Change CPI provision is an effort that President Obama has embraced and said he's willing to go with, which would cut the cost of living allowance for so many millions, tens of millions of recipients of Social Security. And Scott, I think of it similar to like the integrity of an egg. If you crack an egg, you have done something to its structural integrity. And in a similar way, if for the first time to whittle down Social Security benefits or raise the Medicare eligibility age, this is really a Rubicon that politically and socially we need to make sure isn't crossed. So, you know, whether people live in Connecticut or anywhere else in this country, I think now is the time, in January of 2013, to say to members of the Senate and the House representing us, no, we won't accept any of these cuts whatsoever.
Agreed. And our guest last week, Robert Eskow from the Campaign for America's Future, he basically said something I very much agree with, and I'm sure you will too, and that is, President Obama, if he goes down this road, will be giving the Republicans cover for their long-time, decades-long mission to start to unravel the New Deal and Great Society social safety net programs. And a Democrat, for the first time, if Obama does this, will you know, as you said, pull the trigger on the unraveling of these programs.
Yes, absolutely. There are two sort of there's a standard, and then I think what may be unfortunately more accurate interpretation of Obama's conduct in terms of dealing with, negotiating with Republican leaderships in the House and Senate. The more traditional one we're getting a lot now in the media is President Obama, he just doesn't know how to negotiate, and he goes in and he gives too much ground, and he's too willing to compromise. He doesn't understand how to hold his cards and play them well. Well, when it's so chronic after so many years, and he's still doing the same thing, and he's a very, very smart guy, it may well be that he doesn't have a problem cutting these so-called entitlements. In fact, he's made many statements to indicate that he believes it is necessary to cut back on Social Security and Medicare. And after all, he appointed the heads of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, who both are enemies of Social Security and Medicare. So many other ways that whether or not we accept this notion that he can't negotiate well, progressives need to recognize at this point he's not our ally. He's an adversary in so many ways, and so we need to say that these issues are far more important than any personal warmth that we may have towards Obama.
And, you know, it's really frustrating given the fact that polling across the board, whether it's Republicans, Democrats, Independents, even Tea Party activists oppose these cuts. So the entire country is arrayed against these proposed slashing benefit cuts to these social safety net programs. So it's hard to know where the pressure is coming from. But maybe that's an entire other program, because there's a lot to discuss there. Norman, before you go, and we run out of time, I wanted to ask you about your recent congressional run in the north coast of California in the 2nd District, newly created 2nd District there. Heartbreaking, less than 200-vote loss to be in the election day runoff, which you have a new system out there. I guess there's nonpartisan primaries, so you finished just a couple of hundred or less votes short of being in the main election in November. What lessons do you take from that experience? Certainly you had to raise a lot of money, which you did successfully. You were snubbed by the Democratic Party apparatus, from what I read. Where do you go from here in terms of electoral politics, if anywhere?
Well, I think collectively progressives need to open those doors as much as possible for state legislature, for Congress, for city councils across the country. We can do it. We do things much more difficult than getting elected, but it means groundwork. It does take raising money. I often quote statement by the 19th century Paul Mark Hanna. He said, there are two crucial things in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember the second. And my point is, we've got to remember the second, and that has to do with organizing. So I encourage people, jump into the pool. A lot of times we will lose, but sometimes we will win. And a recent piece I wrote in The Nation magazine on this is posted on my website, as well as the Progressive Caucus article that you mentioned, and that's at normansolomon.com.
So you think another congressional run is in your future?
Well, I haven't made any plans to do that, and frankly, I don't want to jump into any race without feeling that there's a plausible chance to win. I'm 40 years into being part of protest politics, but I don't believe particularly in protest candidacies. So I don't know that I'll run, but what I do know is I'm working to support progressive candidates across the country who will be on the ballot in the next few years.
After your campaign, you talked about embarking on a long-term progressive coalition to build such a coalition. Any particular projects that you want to let our listeners know about?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have a website, grassrootsprogress.org, and at grassrootsprogress.org, we're morphing my campaign into that sort of long-term coalition. And long story short, just this weekend, we had caucuses of the Democratic Party throughout California, and within the congressional district, we organized for the two state assembly districts. We endorsed 23 candidates for the state central committee. All 23 of them won, and there was only 24 seats total that we were contesting. So it's an example that we can do it. Si se puede, not only in so many other realms of political activism, but including politically in terms of the Democratic Party. But we got to be willing to organize and fight the power and challenge those at the top.
Well, Norman, it's always great to talk with you. It's inspiring and gets me off my funk here, my negative funk. Thanks for all that you do and all the hard work you do on behalf of progressives around the country. So thanks again for making time to be part of our program tonight.
Oh, well, thank you, Scott, and thanks for all the great radio work you've been doing for so many years.
Thanks, Norman. Look forward to talking again soon.
Me too.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Norman Solomon, activist, columnist, author, and recent congressional candidate, talking to us about what obviously is a failing of the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives, which failed to be an obstacle towards the compromises that developed in the first hours of 2013 with the fiscal cliff tax deal that most in the Progressive Caucus supported, and with high stakes negotiations upcoming in terms of the issues of budget cuts and slashing of the social safety net programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, some kind of cohesive hanging together of that Progressive Caucus would seem to be quite important in the coming weeks. So Norman Solomon has two websites that you can check out. That's normansolomon.com, Norman Solomon, SOLOMON.com, and grassrootsprogress.org.